With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The Fifth and Sixth Amendments to the Constitution of the United States guarantee the right against self-incrimination, the right to remain silent, and the right to counsel. A crime wave swept California in the late 1970s. Several young girls were abducted, raped, and murdered. Michael D. Mattson was convicted of these crimes and sentenced to death. Law clerk by day, family man by night. In 1982, Jim Potts, a brilliant, idealistic African-American law student, is honored when one of his professors recruits him to assist in writing a death penalty appeal on behalf of a serial killer. Potts discovers a loophole in the case that somehow had been overlooked, one that could not only get Mattson off death row, but once presented to the Supreme Court of California, could release him to rape and murder again. When Potts confides in his pregnant wife, she says if Mattson goes free, their marriage is over. But if Potts quits the case or withholds information, he violates his duty to client and constitution and risks his career before it even begins. A moral dilemma with no good way out. To avoid losing his family and releasing pure evil back into the world, Potts must be smarter than his options. He must find a way to keep his family together, fulfill his duties, and keep Mattson behind bars. But can he? The book we're featuring this evening is Defending a Serial Killer, The Right to Counsel, with my special guest attorney and author, Jim Potts. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Jim Potts.
Hey, thank you very much for having me, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This is a remarkable story and a very unique perspective you have in this book. As you do in the book, let's talk about Michael D. Mattson.
Well, he was definitely a piece of work. There's no doubt about it. You know, I think that what happened to him was that he was a product of his environment as a child, in all honesty. He went through step-parent situation, and not all step-parents are bad, so let me make that clear. But in his particular case, you know, as a child, his mother started noticing certain things about him, certain things that he was doing. Some people say that he, because of the fact that he was abused by his stepfather, physically abused, that had a definite impact on him, without a doubt. So at a very early age, he was using drugs, and that was part of the problem. He would drink a case of beer, and you're talking about in his teens as an example, and he would get into all kinds of these different drugs that, you know, where you hallucinate, things of that nature. So his childhood was a definite factor, in my opinion, in terms of who he turned out to be. And even the court-appointed psychologist related back to the same time frame that he may have been impacted mentally because of the way that he was abused and the things that he saw. Because he was not only abused, but his mother was abused by this person as well. Mm-hmm. So those are factors for him. But his mother started noticing things about him as well, with him wearing female clothing, as an example. One time she caught him in a field and he was wearing a dress, and other things that he would do that, you know, that concerned her. He had this one episode where he had a young friend of his where he actually made the kid strip down, whipped the kid, and stuck a broomstick up his rear, you know, things of that nature. And so, again, this was at a very, very young age and made the kid walk home like that. You know, what was interesting and what I didn't find was what the parents of that child even did or how they reacted to any of that. Unfortunately, I don't have that. His mother was the one that related the information from that perspective in terms of what happened. So he just developed, in my opinion, into this monster. And I think it really did start with the abuse that he, you know, that he received, as well as the abuse that he saw. Now, he may have used alcohol and drugs as an escape, in my opinion, but I think those things eventually overtook him. So he, as he moved along, he ended up going into service. He was up in Oregon. And when he was up there, he basically went AWOL. And while he was away, when he wasn't supposed to be, he actually kidnapped this young lady and her brother, both of them. And as a result of that, he was convicted. He raped her, robbed her, basically made the brother leave and drove off in the car and took her to a secluded place. So he eventually got caught, and he had to do time for that crime, obviously. Now, the purpose, people argue that the purpose of you go to jail, you're supposed to rehabilitate, et cetera. But the sad part in his particular case was that he didn't rehabilitate, because is what he did was in his mind, he developed this attitude that in the future, if he in fact engages in the same behavior, which he intended to do, then he would kill his victims so that the victims could not come back and testify against him. And that's the sad part about this with him, is that his mind, in my opinion, was so demented at that time that it was just a matter of time when he would go even further and include murder in his actions. So I hope that answered your basic question on him.
Mm-hmm. You talked about, you mentioned and you write about a counselor named Jacobs that spoke to him about 12 months before any of this killing occurred. And she had some dramatic conclusions based on what he had said to her regarding women and his hatred for them.
The reason why I think he hated women was because, from what I understood from the relationship he had with his mother, is that his mother did not protect him from the abuse of the stepfather.
Right.
And as a result of that, he was psychologically damaged. Because, and again, I'm not a psychologist, let me make that clear, but he resented that. Mothers normally, and I'm just speaking in general now, are supposed to protect their children. And I think children look for that protection. And when it wasn't there, I think that psychologically damaged him. And that's why he hated women. But, you know, the odd part about that, Dan, is that if he hated women so much, why did he dress in women's clothes? I mean, even when he got captured, there was female attire in the car. And the mother, when the police officers called her, she told him, oh, yeah, there would be women's clothes in his car, because she knows that he dresses women. So think about that for a second. Where's the conflict there? It's just a point that proves that he was just so mentally scrambled, so to speak, that he turned into this monster. Because if he hated women, why would you dress as a woman? you have to wonder.
You call him a gamester, but still, he was deemed competent to stand trial by a judge.
He was a gamester. He was a good-looking guy, and he would use those looks to lure these young women in, including his very first victim, all of them actually, except for the very last one when he got caught in Las Vegas. That one was just a forced situation, but the other ones were forced situations. He used his looks and his charm, so to speak, to lure these women in. And that's the sad part. But that's why I said he's a gangster. He is. He was.
You write in July 1978 in Los Angeles, you and your wife Betty were expecting your first child. It was a complicated pregnancy. You were working full-time and attending law school 5 nights a week. There's a lot of pressure on you. And tell us about newscast that you happened to view at that time.
We were watching TV, and just to back up for a second, yeah, Betty was bedridden at 2 months with the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
So for her, she was very in tune to this business about having a child and things of that nature. So basically what was going on, we were watching, the news as people do in the evening, fixing dinner, whatever the case may be, and we saw the situation where the little girl had been was missing. Let's start off with that, was missing.
Right.
And that there was a manhunt that was going on. L.A. County Sheriff's Department was handling that. And, you know, they were talking about the fact that this little girl was missing from the community park that she and her sibling was at. And everybody's looking for her, basically. And she was only 9 years old. So as you can imagine, you got a 9-year-old is missing, and these days it doesn't matter whether they're 9 or whatever the age is. People are going to try to do a manhunt. They go door to door, and they start searching. So L.A. County Sheriff's Department was on the news talking about that we had a 9-year-old girl missing, and they wanted to put the information out there. Have you seen her? I think we've all seen those types of newscasts. Even today, you see them from time to time. So that caught our attention. Now, at first, it was just a little girl missing, which is always a sad situation. They suspected something was going on, but they did not know. And then I believe it was the maintenance person who said that he had seen this particular vehicle, okay, and that he thinks that the girl may have gotten into the vehicle, which is even worse at that point, because then it turned from a missing child to a kidnapped missing child, and that makes a big difference.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened. So, of course, we discussed it. I mean, people, you know, you're laying there, and it's, oh, my God, 9-year-old girl missing, possibly abducted. And those kind of things will always, make the normal civil person very upset. I think I mentioned in the book, I'm trying to remember if I mentioned in the book or not, about the fact that the same child that Betty was pregnant with, that's my oldest son now, he was almost abducted out of the grocery store. So,
like,
you know, years later. No, it wasn't even years later. It would have been roughly after he was born, probably a year and a half, maybe 2 years old. He was sitting in the grocery cart. No, he was a baby. And Betty had left the cart there, walked down the aisle. You know how you walk down the aisle because you're looking for something up on the shelf? And she turned around, and this individual had lifted him up out of the car, and she started screaming and everything. He set him back down and ran out of the store. So abductions are really something that's almost a parent's nightmare, and that was the situation with this child.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you do mention that in the book. Pardon me. You do write about that incredible, more than coincidence, and relation to this case. You say that she was eventually found. And what was the condition that she was found in? What were some of the circumstances?
She was unfortunately found at a park, Whittier Narrows, and when they found her, she had this puka shell necklace wrapped around her throat, and she had been strangled. the body was partially covered. And it didn't take them long to ascertain, obviously, that she had been murdered, and also sodomized as well. She was only 9 years old. So that was very upsetting. Fecal matter immediately was spotted on her rear, and so they know that it was a situation where she had been brutally murdered and also sodomized as well.
And this is Cheryl Christie Gutierrez.
Correct.
Yes. And at the same time, for our listeners, the Hillside Strangler have terrorized Los Angeles around this same time or previous. Correct.
That's correct. And actually, when he ended up getting caught in Nevada, when the sheriff's department went out there, or the LAP, when they went out there, they thought that possibly at first that he was the Hillside Strangler.
Mm-hmm.
But they did not know that he was the one associated with these deaths. They were thinking at a whole different level. So it didn't take them long to figure out what was going on, because he basically told them, you know, what he had done. So then the gears switched. Let's put it that way. So then the investigation opened up into not only her death, but several other deaths. So they had to go to Nevada to do this. But then I'm sure we're going to get into what happened all out there, because those are part of the problems that created the dilemma, so to speak, things that I had found out.
So tell us what happens in the investigation to find the killer of Cheryl Christie Gutierrez. And then you talk about July 20th and Deanna Muskwidge, which was 16 years old, is also missing.
You know, here's the problem. The problem is parents try to tell kids, don't hitchhike. Don't get into cars with strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happens. Let's back up on Cheryl. Cheryl was upset because she wanted to go home. They were at the park. They were swimming. They were all having a good time, but she wanted to go home, and her sibling was not ready to go home yet. So she was upset. And Michael Mattson saw something that was going on because she was crying and basically lured over to the car and then told her he would take her home. So she got into the car. The other ones, the same thing. The only ones who didn't voluntarily get into the car was the last person, which we'll get to, because she was in Nevada. And so luring people in, people telling their children don't hitchhike, is always the message that they need to do. So the investigation, to answer your question, you want to know specifically on the investigation, that would have taken place in Nevada. So do you want me to switch gears and go into Nevada, into the investigation and what happened?
Yes, do that.
Okay. What happened was that Michael Mattson, on his last situation in California, he actually did not kill his victim. His victim basically pleaded for her life, et cetera, and for some reason, he didn't kill her. Now, when he was interviewed, he said the only reason why he didn't kill her was because she was pleading for her life, but that he also couldn't find a rock big enough to bash her head in.
Right.
So he ended up taking her and dropping her back off. So he realized afterwards, now he has left a victim alive that could describe him and his vehicle, et cetera. So he takes off and goes to Nevada. So he gets to Nevada, but he doesn't really have that much money. He just, on the spur of the moment, decided he better leave. So he drives to North Las Vegas, where he's just about running out of gas. So he goes to the local junior college there, and by that time it's at night. So what happened was he spotted a female student going to her car, and he basically, at gunpoint, forced her into the car because he wanted some money for gas. What she didn't know is that the gun was actually a BB gun. It wasn't a real gun. It was a BB gun. But she don't know that. It's at night. It's a gun. Get in the car. And that's what she did. So he forces him into the car. He knows that he doesn't have a gun. He takes us to the secluded area and basically rapes her, but he doesn't have gas. So then they go back to the gas station. They go back to a gas station.
Incredible.
And at the gas station, she figures out that she's got to get away. This is her opportunity. And when he's out there, out of the car, she basically jumps out and runs into the station and tells the attendant what's going on. So, of course, they call the police. Pat Dingell was a detective at the North Las Vegas Police Department. So he gets the call at night, and he goes up there, and he starts looking around. And, of course, he finds, the car. And he starts investigating the car, but he's still not sure of what's going on, to make a long story short.
Right.
It's at night. He goes back. But then the victim ends up going to the hospital, and they end up calling, and so he's able to interview, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they put the word out on the vehicle license plate. The vehicle license plate is to California and comes back under Michael B. Massey. But he's not equating that with anything going on in California. Of course, he's just equating it to this particular situation with this victim in North Las Vegas. So he puts out on the teletype, because it's too late at that point to call California. So he puts out on the teletype, description of what happened, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He ends up getting a call from L.A. County about this particular situation. And the investigators end up going out because, again, they're thinking he's the Hillside Triangle situation.
Right.
But during this time, Pat Dingell figures out, wait a minute, there's something going on, because Pat felt that this particular individual, there's something going on with him. Now, he's not in custody. I'm sorry, I should back up. He's not in custody yet. All right, so even though the word was put out on the teletype and they got a call about it, they weren't going out there yet because Matson hadn't been captured.
Right.
So Matson ends up going up to driving to, because he had grandparents that lived in Ely. I guess that's how you pronounce it, Ely, Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
So the sheriff up there, Sheriff Robinson, knew about a family that was in that particular area, because again, when you send out a teletype, it goes out all across the country, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So they picked up on it, and he goes to the grandparents' house and just happened to knock on the door, say, listen, we're looking for a Michael D. Matson. Would you happen to know him? Well, meanwhile, Matson had driven up there, and again, it was still a gas issue, so he ends up going to his grandparents' house. Walking, gets to his grandparents' house. So when Sheriff Robinson got there, the grandparents came to the door, and they said, "Do you know Michael D. Matson?" And, of course, they looked at each other. "Well, yeah, that's our grandson. Well, do you know where he is?" "Well, yeah, he's inside sleeping." So, of course, Robinson was shocked because he got lucky at that point, from that perspective. It's not always that easy, trust me when I tell you. But, what's he done now? I mean, so the grandparents even knew that he had a bad background, but that's still their grandson. They're not going to turn him away. They don't know what he's done most recently. They only know what happened in Oregon. So Matson comes to the door, and Robinson takes him into custody, takes him back to the station. Pat Dingell and his partner Reed, they find out because Robinson calls and says, "Hey, I got your guy in custody," basically. So they drive up there. And Pat told me, as soon as he looked at this individual, in his mind, this guy was pure evil. And again, he did not fully know everything that Matson had done. He only knew about what happened with this victim in North Las Vegas.
Right.
On the ride back, he was in the back with Matson. And Pat told me this, and it just, from my perspective, being with my background and even being a police officer, that, I was a reserve police officer as well with L.A. County Sheriff's Department. It was just wrong. He confided in me that he, in fact, had taken his gun and put it in Matson's mouth and, threatened him, et cetera. And that, to me, was wrong. But, again, nobody knew this at that time. This is information that came out way after his conviction. I'll get to that, you know, a little bit later. But at any rate, he gets him out. And of course, they did read him his rights. They told him that, you know, he had a right to remain silent, et cetera. So they did what they were supposed to do from that standpoint. So the ride back from Eli was about 3 hours. So they get back to North Las Vegas. And that's where things, in my opinion, started going. To me at that time, the knowledge that I had when I was doing the research, where things started going a little strange. Because at the time of the appeal, I did not know that Pat had done that with a gun in the mouth, et cetera. I didn't find that out until, right, you know, years later, to make a long story short. Right. And that was after the appeal. But what happened was Pat put the word out that he was in custody. Then, as a result of that, he learns that Matson may have been involved in other crimes in California. And he had suspected that this guy has probably done something like this before. Mm-hmm. So now information is starting to come in. So Pat, in my opinion, starts looking at this like the highlight of his career. And in conversations that I had with him, Pat was a very unique person in terms of his background. I mean, he became a detective at a very early age because he was just very good at what he did. And so he starts developing a relationship. So when you start talking about an investigation, at some point, he's entitled to have counsel present during these kinds of conversations, quote,
right,
you know, investigation type of questions. Matson had already said that he wanted to talk to an attorney, and that was not afforded to him at that point. Pat started developing a relationship with Matson. He started luring him in my opinion. So you want to talk about a gangster? Pat at that point was becoming a gangster himself because right, he looked at Matson as pure the evil. He wanted to make sure Matson was going to end up getting convicted. And so he started doing things that police officers should not be doing because why? He got emotionally involved with the situation. And in my opinion, police officers cannot get emotionally involved with the system. We're not the judge and jury. Our job and his job was to arrest him. And yes, you can ask him questions, but he has a right to counsel. And this is what this is all about. He would go and have Michael come into the interrogation room, give him coffee, cigarettes, at one point even promise him some drugs. I mean, he was luring him into this false sense of security, and that to me was wrong. But at any rate, he had put out that Matson's in custody, and, you know, different agencies came out to talk to him. And again, that's when Pat started realizing it, that he had really caught possibly a person that, I don't want to say would enhance his career, but was probably like a career situation that everybody wants to get, you know, with somebody like this because it's a serial killer or whatever the case may be.
Sure.
And that's exactly what happened. I think Pat let that go to his head. And again, when they came out to interrogate him, he has a right to counsel. Now, Pat had been in touch with the attorney, which was the local public defender's office, and they said, yeah, go ahead and talk to him, which to me is wrong. But whatever, it happened. So they would come out and they questioned him. They quickly realized during this part of the investigation that he was not the Hillside Strangler. What Matson told them was, I can tell you about some things, you know, that I did that you don't even know about. And then, of course, your ears are going to perk up. Well, what are you talking about? So that's when he turns around, and basically with all of this and with Pat's influences, et cetera, and luring him into a false sense of security, he basically tells them about the crimes and even draws a map for one of the victims where they can find her. So that opened up the door to there being issues and his violation of his rights. I'm just going on. I don't know if you have questions in between any of this because I'm kind of just moving forward with this.
You're giving us information. The thing is now once this has happened, once these Dingell has got this confession, you also when we talked about you hearing about this case of the Gutierrez, Cheryl Gutierrez being killed, and having that fateful conversation with your wife, Betty, you now find out information about Mattson involved with this in another event where you're, again, this fateful intersection here where you come to be aware of this. And then you tell us how Ron Smith, your professor, law professor in law school, who had taken you under your wing, gives you a call. So tell us about this event and the event where your professor calls you.
Well, here's what happened. Ron was my first year. Ron was my instructor in my first year. And Ron contacts me and says, because he knew I had an interest also in criminal law. Ron contacts me and says, basically, hey, Jimmy, I just got appointed by Justice Rose Byrd to handle a death penalty case. Because in California, any time that you're convicted and sentenced to death, it's an automatic appeal to the California Supreme Court. So Ron calls me and says, hey, listen, would you be interested in working with me on this case, you know, on this appeal? And hey, as a law student, you jump at an opportunity like that, of course. I mean,
sure.
You know, you can practice law and never have, you know, in a lifetime and never have an opportunity like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I jumped at the opportunity without knowing all of the details, just a death penalty case is heading to the to the California Supreme Court. So, of course, you're excited. So there was like 4,000 pages of transcripts and exhibits. And so once I got those and I'm starting to go through those exhibits and the transcripts, et cetera, I realized what this guy has done, because now it's in detail with all of these victims and what he actually did to them, et cetera. So I start having that conversation because, you know, it's the pillow talk conversation, as they say. You know, it's my wife. We're talking about these things. I'm like, oh, my God. Let me tell you what this guy did, you know, and that's where the conflict started, because at that point she's like, you know, wait a minute, you know, you can't help somebody like this, you know, and then I started looking at my personal values versus my personal values, my moral values versus, you know, the requirement that you have to represent to the best of your ability, so the ethical responsibilities to a client. So that took some soul searching. I mean, I was an altar boy. I was an Eagle Scout, went to all Catholic schools. I mean, this guy was everything that I wasn't. I mean, I was just the opposite.
Yeah.
So when she put it in my mind about the fact that you can't represent somebody like this, I mean, it is something for you to think about, you know. So while I was thinking about it, of course, I was still reading and doing some of the things that I had to do anyway, because I still had a responsibility to Ron. So eventually, I had to tell Betty that, well, you know, I've made a decision, and the decision is I'm going to go ahead and, you know, assist Ron in this particular case, in this appeal. And that's when she really became upset, because it was like, listen, you can't do this. If that guy gets off, we're done. And, you know, that's not something you want to hear. You expect support.
No.
You know, any spouse, in my opinion, should always support another spouse, and understanding what the implications of a comment like that may be. So then that's when the conflict sets in, you know, at a higher level. And I had to just simply tell her, look, if I'm getting into this profession, it's clear that, you know, you can't get out of it just because you find the subject matter repugnant. And
right.
What I'm not going to do is be influenced, you know, one way or another, you know, regarding, you know, career decisions. You know, we had the conversation, because you're a spouse, we talk about these things, but you can't decide for me or force me to decide in a manner that's going to be contrary to a career that I'm getting ready to enter. So she obviously was unhappy about that, but then again, we didn't have the outcome yet. So it's if, you know, he gets off, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like, well, whatever the case may be, it's my job working with Ron to be able to look at all of the possibilities as to whether or not any of his rights were violated, the case. Because at that point, keep in mind, Dan, he was a self-confessed killer at that point. So
right.
It's not like we didn't have information as if, you know, he got railroaded, you know, in the courtroom, so to speak. It wasn't like that. I mean, you know, his confession got in, basically. And that led towards, you know, toward him being convicted.
So having said that, I'm going to move on with this. She was not happy. Things were a little bit strained, but the outcome wasn't there yet. So, you know, things settled to a certain extent anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So then I go through all of this, and I'm looking, and I'm reading the transcripts. I'm reading police reports. And when I'm reading the police reports and everything, I'm looking at the fact that he was given his rights at the time that he was picked up in Ely, Nevada, from Sheriff Robinson. It's a three-hour drive, from, you know, as I mentioned earlier, from Ely back to North Las Vegas. So when Pat Dingell continued to ask him questions after they got back, that to me was problematic because that was going on before he had actually secured, you know, proper counsel, which, again, was a public defender at that time. And I won't say anything negative about public defenders. Dan, you know, I mean, they've got a list of cases that they have to handle, and it makes it very, very tough on them. But they still do a great job, in my opinion, as best as they can anyway. So that, to me, was problematic. And I looked at that, did some research on it, and then had a conversation with Ron. So I go to Ron and I say, Ron, you know, I've concluded my, you know, my thoughts on this. I looked through everything. So Ron and I agreed to meet. So when we met, Ron was all excited because he had found an issue that they had read the wrong jury instruction. So that instead of Mattson getting the death penalty, that Mattson should have gotten life in imprisonment without the possibility of parole. And I'm looking at Ron thinking to myself, okay, why does he not see what I see here? He's talking about the wrong jury instruction, and what I'm looking at and reading is that his rights got violated under the Fifth and Sixth Amendments. And, you know, I'm looking at a bigger issue here. I'm thinking maybe I missed the boat. So I get into this conversation with Ron about it. I said, Ron, I think there's another issue here. And he's like, what are you talking about? So I start relating some of the same facts that I related to you. And I said, I think his rights have been violated under the Fifth and Sixth Amendments. And Ron was like, what? You're crazy. No. You know? And again, I'm just a law student. So I argued it so hard. I ended up arguing it so hard that Ron said, look, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll include your argument in the brief. Okay. Well, when we you only have 1 hour to argue in front of the California Supreme Court. So Ron was arguing his issue for about the first 10 minutes, and then the justice looked at him and said, you know, Mr. Smith, there's a bigger issue here than the wrong jury instruction. So then he switched to my issue for the last 50 minutes. And as a result of that, now, I don't want to get into it. You don't want me to get into the conclusion, do you?
What do
you want
yet.
Me to do with the conclusion? Right, okay, I'll stop right there. At any rate, he did make my argument, and the justices, you know, went out, you know, to debate it. They don't make, you know, decisions right on the spot, so let me just put it that way.
Yeah. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is ZocDoc. When you need a doctor, you need a doctor now. Not in a few days, not in a few weeks, and definitely not in a few months. If you need to see an MD, ASAP, we've got a solution. Just download the free ZocDoc app, the easiest way to find a great doctor and instantly book an appointment. With ZocDoc, you can search for local doctors who take your insurance, read verified patient reviews, and book an appointment in person or video chat. Never wait on hold with a receptionist again. Whether you need a primary care physician, dentist, dermatologist, psychiatrist, eye doctor, or other specialist, ZocDoc has you covered. Go to ZocDoc.com/TrueMurder and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free. Every month, millions of people use ZocDoc, and I'm one of them. It's my go-to whenever I need to see a doctor. ZocDoc is great. You should try it. ZocDoc makes healthcare easy. Now is the time to prioritize your health. Go to ZocDoc.com/TrueMurder and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free and book a top-rated doctor. Many are available as soon as today. That's ZocDoc.com/TrueMurder. Now, Jim, we were talking about
the appeal courts and the issues that you and Ron Smith brought up in the briefs in front of the Supreme Court. Tell us
California
what
Supreme
happens.
Court.
Pardon me?
Yeah, the California Supreme Court, just to be clear. Uh-huh.
Yes, yes, the California. So what happens as a result of this this argument in terms of a reversal? What happens?
Well, look, first of all, there's another point that I want to make, okay, if you don't mind. The problem is with the judicial system, and what the book is truly trying to point out as well, is that when it comes to the judicial system, we have to leave the emotions out of the judicial system. And that's very difficult when you have crimes that are committed like this, because people are going to be emotionally tied to it. Police officers can be emotionally tied to it. But what I'm also trying to get across in the book is that we have to leave the emotions out of the process. If you don't do that and you make the mistakes like Pat Dingell made because he got emotionally tied to this, then is what ends up happening is that the criminal can actually get off. The criminal can actually walk. And then the victim's rights, okay, are gone at that point. The victims need to be, their rights need to be protected as well. And when you get emotionally involved with this, and it's hard, and I get it, but police officers, judges, I want to say the jury, but the juries do try to reach the emotions of the juries when they're trying to make a decision as well, and that's a little bit different. The people in the process that are part of the judicial system, to me, are the ones that I'm really kind of focused on, and police officers in general, they can't get tied to it. They are not the judge and jury. And what Dingell did was that he was steering things into a direction based upon his emotions to ensure that this person, in fact, was going to be convicted. Now, let me just back up for a second, because remember, we also talked about the fact that he was in Nevada, and he committed a Nevada crime.
Right.
He did not want to stand trial in Nevada. He did not want to be convicted in Nevada, because he felt that the jail systems in California were better than the jail systems that would be in Nevada. And he even made a comment that he would rather go to a California facility where he could work in the kitchen, because he'd have access to liver, which he could use to help stimulate himself. So this guy was really, he was really off in a lot of different respects. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
So that's why they basically gave the opportunity for him to be transferred. Now, his attorney at that time okayed the fact that he would be transferred. And then later on, he did not realize that Mattson had done the things that he had done in California, which I don't understand. But again, I can't put myself in his shoes of why he did or didn't do his due diligence. But he okayed the fact that Mattson would be transferred to California. Otherwise, Mattson could have been convicted in Nevada and, you know, done jail time there before he came back to California. And obviously, with a crime like this, they don't want that. Californians would want him back here. So everybody was in agreement at that point. And again, Mattson had confessed, et cetera. The other point that I want to make is that the families, people don't realize it's not just the victims, it's the families that can be so impacted by these different types of events. To this day, some of these families, you know, cannot forget, you know, what had happened. And so their rights have to be vindicated to know and to feel that the person responsible has truly paid the price. Now, you asked me basically what was the outcome of the decision by the California Supreme Court, correct?
Yes.
They reversed the conviction based upon my argument. So it was reversed, but what happened was that Superior Court, the prosecuting attorneys decided to retry the case. And that's what they did. When they retried the case, he was again found guilty, but this time they excluded the confession. And the reason they did that, obviously, is because it was in violation of his rights. Mm-hmm. Because of the crimes that he had committed, they just did not want to say, okay, he's out, and end the story. So they basically retried the case. But remember what I told you. The last victim he did not kill.
Yeah.
She was able to come back and testify against him. And that's what got him convicted for the second time.
Yeah.
His appeals, I kid you not, these guys, when they get convicted and they're up there on death row in the whole nine yards, these guys all become jailhouse lawyers. They all know each other. They all talk about the appeals. The appeals process is part of the problem. But let's back up to my personal relationship. At that point, I've done my job. My wife is not unhappy because the guy ended up being retried and did not get back out on the street. So that changed everything at that point, you know, in terms of the concerns that Betty may have had. And, of course, I was happy because, you know, my marriage was intact at that point, and he didn't get off, and I had done what I was supposed to do. He spent, I kid you not, and I was involved in looking at some of the appeals on him over the years, and I had transcripts. I had secured some of the appeals and all of that. Prior to writing the book as well. So I had access to a lot more information. In addition to that, I had access to Pat Dingell.
Mm-hmm.
Pat Dingell made me promise, okay, about certain things that he had told me,
right,
that I would not be able to put in the book. Pat Dingell has passed away. Michael Mattson passed away in prison, by the way. But he was masterful at all of his appeals over the years. I told you he's a gangster. He died in prison, and that's the good news. But then I was able to write the book because the information that I had learned from Pat could not have been used to, because anytime you have additional information, it could always go toward the appeal and possibly get, once again, his conviction reversed.
Right.
After Pat passed away, which is in the book, I was able to divulge some of the information that I had that I sat on for all of that time. So Mattson died in prison. One of his family members took the body, and he's buried in Nevada. Oh, actually, he's not that far, probably. I think it's from his grandparents' house. So that's what happened.
Some of the issues that we didn't explore here were in your argument before the California Supreme Court. You interviewed Pat Dingell, like you say, and then he confided in you things like putting the gun in the mouth of Mattson for a 3.5 hour
right.
ride, and that he was going to circumvent his rights. He didn't care about his rights. He knew that this person was guilty. But some of the issues that you had, you were a police officer, a law enforcement officer with the L.A. County Sheriff's Department for 20 years, so you know what a cop meant, and you had your moral compass straight. What are the things that you argued, and especially things like that California had different rules, and as far as Pat Dingell becoming an agent when negotiating with other people?
Right. He became an agent of California at that point. So mm-hmm. they do have different rules regarding that. And that was one of the reasons why it stood up, because of the fact that when he started the investigation based upon the crimes in California and the information that he was soliciting, he then became a part of the law enforcement agency, so to speak, of California, not Nevada at that point. If he had stuck to just the Nevada crime, that's one thing, but that's not what he did. And he ended up overstepping his bounds because, again, I think he looked at this as a career situation where you don't get to get involved in necessarily a serial killer and then capturing a serial killer. So he actually became an agent of the law enforcement agencies when he's pumping Mattson for this information and turning the information over, because he actually came out and testified as well. And, of course, when he testified, he perjured himself because – he was asked whether or not he had, you know, given Mattson his rights, you know, every single time.
Mm-hmm.
And he testified to that. And that was not true. He did not do that because, as I told you, he would have cigarette breaks with him, coffee breaks with him, and be asking him questions and everything and luring him into a false sense of security. So he violated the rights even with doing that and even violated his own principles because he was, Dan, he was a very highly principled individual, but he let this get under his skin.
Sure.
And that was the bad part about it. So he became an agent of the law enforcement agencies in California. By the way, he solicited the information, received the information, and passed the information on, and then he actually perjured himself as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's stop for this message from our sponsor.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, you talked about, as well, that the felony of the felony crimes of rape and kidnap that were only given to the courts, or they only knew about this information from Mattson himself, and there was no evidence backing that up. Tell us how that was an issue in this appeal as well.
His confession, because remember, all these other individuals were deceased at that point. So only Mattson could have related any of these things, such as the kidnappings and what happened, etc. The only person who had anything, I mean, the last victim, of course, not the last California victim, was able to identify him and testify against him in court. But everything else before that was information that came out of Mattson's mouth. They had nothing to tie him to any of these crimes. There was no evidence found. There was no DNA sample. There was none of that. So it was only that the information was provided by Mattson, and that information was solicited in violation of his Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights. That was the problem.
How did they make the retrial, how did they get around not having the confession? And you've mentioned that they didn't have any direct evidence of any of the details of the kidnap and rape other than his confession. So how did they get this conviction without that evidence?
The question normally that comes up is things like double jeopardy. Well, wait a minute, he had already been tried, can you do it again? And the answer is yes, okay, because if they find that there's a reversal because it was a problem with the way it was conducted. Because sometimes people don't understand that, so that's why I'm explaining that. So he does have an opportunity. They do have an opportunity to retry. They just can't use the information, which was the confession, in the way his confession was obtained. They had to leave those pieces out. But remember, the last victim was not killed. So they could use the testimony of that person to bring him back in and retry him based her testimony,
right,
as an example. So they can always bring it back. They just can't use certain things. So she was able to testify in terms of what had happened as well. The information around the confession was still available.
Mm-hmm.
The confession is one thing, but he had other knowledge where he drew the map, he did things of that nature that still linked him back to a certain extent.
Right.
And remember that I told you that the maintenance person had seen a little girl with him with the car. So they pieced together enough other information to say what this... Because, remember, the jury only has to convict, beyond a reasonable doubt. And they had beyond a reasonable doubt. So it still satisfies it. So ultimately, he was sentenced to death again.
You talk about him being a gamester behind bars, and again, utilizing his legal abilities
to be
able to. Yeah, he was able to game this system for a long time until his death, wasn't he?
Yeah, because people don't understand the appeal process, and that's part of the frustrations, quite frankly, that the families have, the families of the victims that they have. these types of issues where a person can manipulate the system. Because remember, he can go to, let's just take the conviction, the last conviction. Well, he can appeal that to the Court of Appeals. So what did he argue on his first one? Was that the jury was not made up of a jury of his peers.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the first argument. Those aren't my peers.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and my attorney was incompetent. They make those standard arguments. So then you lose that at the appeal process, and then you appeal it to the Supreme Court. Then once all of the appeals are exhausted in California, what do they turn to? Now they do a federal writ of habeas corpus that California's holding me illegally. And now the process starts all over again. It's gamesters. These guys are gamesters at that level.
You talk about, too, the political issues, especially with appointees, and also there's, again, something different in California regarding this. Tell us about how politics has a big influence in this, especially with people with pro-death penalty statuses or as opposed to the other people opposing them.
You know, what's interesting is in California is that we're one of only one of two states where the Supreme Court justices actually can be voted out. We don't have life tenure here for California Supreme Court justices. And again, there's only two states that have that. And Justice Rose Byrd, as an example, she and two others, maybe three, they turned around and got, you know, ended up getting rid of the death penalty in California. So that's how she ended up getting voted out. So there are political issues that are associated, in politics that is associated with this, and the California voters got very upset about that, voted them out because they wanted it back. That's how Charles Manson got off of death row, was because of Justice Rose Byrd, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, so the politics plays into it because you get these different governors. Like right now, we have a governor that says, there's not going to be any executions in California. So politics does play a role.
I always thought it was interesting for a liberal state like California to have the death penalty, but then have this obvious no one hardly is actually put to death from death row. And yet there still is this desire in that state by some people to continue with this, and the time and the money and expense, I don't know, doesn't seem to be worth it.
You know, that's part of the problem is that, again, people work off of emotions. The reason why if they think we get rid of the death penalty altogether, that's going to create a surge of people killing people, and then you don't have to worry about it because of the fact that you're never going to be put to death. California's been up and down on this for decades. And then with the lethal injection, that became a whole big issue also. So then they suspended it based upon the lethal injection arguments that whether or not there's going to be pain, no pain, things of that nature.
Yeah.
It's just going to always be a political, football, so to speak.
Sure.
Newsom says no execution now. But if Newsom loses on his next election because he won the recall situation,
that's right.
And now you turn around and you get a Republican governor, we'll say, then, you know, that could all be, once again, death penalty is back. So they're still on death row. They're just not doing the execution. And I think there's 900 people on death row or something like that right now.
Yeah.
But they may never be executed. Who knows? And it costs a lot of money to leave these guys on death row.
Yeah. You talked about Mattson's death in 2009. How did he die, Providence?
It was weird. I was out of the country at the time, and they were trying to locate me to ask me questions about him at the time of his death. And he died because he illness. Even in his last appeals, this man had appeals almost up to his death. Last time he was in court, he was in court in a wheelchair. So, he very well could have died from complications, as I understand it, associated with HIV. Because remember, he was, I don't want to use the word, I'll say sexually deviant. We'll put it that way. So who knows?
Yeah.
I already told you about how he
you know, felt that he was female in certain respects. So eventually all of that caught up to him, to make a long story short. So he died in prison, basically. Not on death row. At the time that he died, he was put into a prison hospital at another location. So he was not in death row because his time was coming. Let's just put it that way.
Was there any exploration of other murders? Was there any suspicion that he had done other murders?
They had suspicions. There was no doubt about it. You know, there's a lot of unsolved murders out there. And he even denied a couple of them, you know, after he ended up coming back to California. He made some denials. So there's a couple that have gone, we'll just say, that were never solved, let's just put it that way, but that pointed in his direction. So, again, the tough part for the victims' families, that he was probably the one, but they'll never know for sure.
And we talked about your marriage to Betty. Was this case and your work on it instrumental in your split with Betty?
You know, it's, in a way, the answer is probably yes, and I'll tell you why. Because the support mechanisms. Well, to me, spouses always have to support each other.
Mm-hmm.
And she was not a person, in my opinion, that supported my professional ambitions, let's just put it that way. And so that was the beginning of understanding that she was not a supportive person. So I'll leave that like that.
Yeah. You write that you didn't pursue criminal law and you instead went to represent employees in employment law, and you have a very
not
successful
employees,
business.
Employers. Not employees, yeah. Employers. Just to
yes,
clarify.
Oh, pardon me. Yes, employers, pardon me. Much different. Yes, much
right.
Different.
Yeah,
and you also
have a different field. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, it's a different field altogether. You know, when you work in criminal law, you know, and you're defending people, again, you're in a situation where you're defending people that may be contrary to your values as well. Some people do it, it's not an issue. I eventually became an L.A. County Deputy Sheriff Reserve. I was a captain at the time that I retired. So I was all about still enforcing the laws and doing things what I felt was the right way to do that.
I have written, I guess, maybe we shouldn't talk about it, but let's talk about just this book and the first book that you wrote as well.
The first book that I wrote was Right to Counsel. But in that book, I could not put information, because remember I told you that Pat Dingell had told me some things?
Mm-hmm.
So when I wrote the first book, I could not include information in that book that I had because Mattson was still going through his appeals. And information that I had could have, again, took it to the California Supreme Court and possibly reversed his case,
mm-hmm.
his second case. So I had to wait. And after Pat had passed away and Michael Mattson had passed away, then I was free to do something more comprehensive than I was able to do the first time. I even interviewed Pat's wife after Pat had passed away, and mm-hmm. she gave me information. I actually interviewed one of the family members by marriage of Cheryl Gutierrez as well. So you have situations where now you're free to give more information than you were before.
Yeah.
And
it's fascinating. It's a fascinating your interview with Pat Dingell and how candid he is. Again, he gave those conditions, but he trusted you with this information, and it is fascinating his attitude and his how candid he was that he didn't care about this person's rights whatsoever.
You know, part of that is, and the first time I met Pat, Pat and I, we just hit it off. And, you know, he respected, you know, what I had done, and he didn't have an issue with it. And again, because they retried him and and Mattson was convicted a second time. So he respected the judicial system. So let me make that clear. It's just that he got emotionally tied to this one situation.
Yeah.
And that was what was bad.
Yeah. And you understood his plight as well.
Emotions out. Yeah. I'm sorry?
And you understood his plight, his conflict as well.
Yeah.
You understood his position.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Look, nobody wants to hear about somebody that kills kids, rapes them, kidnaps them, sodomizes them, murders them. We, as a society, we're never going to endorse that kind of behavior.
No.
And that can create these emotional responses. I get it. But I'm only saying that when you're part of that system, it's almost like you have to walk the person down the aisle, so to speak. You know, you treat them right. You give them every courtesy. You give them back because, once again, you're not the judge and jury. And it's not for us to determine why somebody does what they do. And that's why in the case itself, you know, in the transcripts, I'm able to read about the different psychologists that talked about why he was the way he was, et cetera. That's why those experts are in place. This is why he did what he did. And people don't think about that in your judicial system. What happened? This is what happened, but this is why it happened. And sometimes that's enough to get somebody off or to get somebody, you know, with a reduced sentence. I mean, there's so many different factors. Pat Dingell did not want that to happen. He wanted everything coming out because he did not want to see this guy walk under any circumstances. And that's not and was not his job.
Yeah. Yes, it's an incredible story. I want to thank you so much for coming on, Jim, and talking about defending a serial killer, the right to counsel. Tell our audience about your weekly radio show and your blog.
I have a weekly radio show, LA Talk Radio. It actually is streaming. I think some people would call it a podcast. But I've been doing that every Sunday, 3 o'clock California time. And we talk about a variety of things. It really started out because I was also a certified terrorist investigator with the LA County Sheriff's Department. So I talk about a lot of things on international terrorism, domestic terrorism, et cetera, how people can be safe under those trying times. I've done active shooter training. I've trained probably over 30,000 people in active shooter training across the country. I've spoken in front of political groups, political associations, et cetera, business associations as well, businesses and schools. The blog is something that I write about my regular 9-to-5. So I've done that probably about 12 years, where every Monday I put out a blog on Listen Up with Jim Potts, and I put out information for employers, for managers and supervisors that they can read on recent cases, situations that they need to be aware of, updates in the law, and things of that nature.
Well, that's fantastic. You're very busy. Thank you so much, Jim Potts, for coming on and talking about your book, Defending a Serial Killer, The Right to Counsel. It's been fascinating.
Thank you
so much, Jim. You have a great evening. Thank you so much. Good night.
Thank you. Bye.